How's everybody doing? Yeah? All right, cool. So my name is Dennis Chen, and I work for the Center for Social Inclusion, which is a racial justice organization. I'm also part of the Gay Asian Pacific Islander Men of New York, and I am on the board of CAV Organizing Asian Communities. You should check out all of those organizations. And I'm really honored to be moderating this wonderful panel today. And we're going to be exploring two case studies that have an impact on our community. And the first is the case around Private Danny Chen. And the second is a case study around the current Occupy CUNY student movement. And so many of you know about the case of Private Danny Chen, who was found dead in his guard post in Afghanistan on October 3rd, 2011, after hazing and racial taunts by his fellow soldiers and his superiors. And it wasn't until December, actually, until this case got national media attention, largely in part due to the efforts of OCA New York. So we are joined today by civil rights attorney and professor Elizabeth Ouyang. She is the president of OCA New York, which is a civil rights organization dedicated to protecting and advancing the political, economic, and cultural rights of Asian Americans. So she's here to share the particulars of that case. And also in today's panel, we also want to talk about the Occupy CUNY movement. And as you know, CUNY is one of the most diverse institutions in the nation. I think the statistics are about 15% Asian American Pacific Islander. And so the Occupy CUNY movement, for people who don't know, it's a movement of students who are calling for free tuition, academic freedom for their faculty, and a general defense of public education. And so we are joined by Martina Storosta and Eva Radivojevic. And they are two filmmakers who are documenting the Occupy CUNY movement today. And they're using the story and legacy of the late Luis Reyes Rivera to draw connections between the Occupy CUNY movement today and the 1969 CUNY occupation, which resulted in open admissions, which was a huge step for racial equity, because previously there weren't a lot of Black and Latino students represented in the CUNY system. So in this panel, we're going to present these two cases, and in the limited time that we have, we're going to try to explore some connections, tensions, questions within and between the two. And hopefully we'll be able to get some questions from the audience as well. So I would first like to introduce Elizabeth Ouyang.
Okay, great. Hi, everybody. Okay. Thank you to the Asian American Research Institute for inviting us. This is a very timely conference, and so we are glad to be here. I couldn't think of a better example of a case that has all the elements of grassroots activism and community grassroots activism than the struggle for justice for Private Danny Chen. Born in Chinatown, New York City, this case has brought together a groundswell of support from elected officials to school principals to classmates, relatives, community-based organizations, ethnic and mainstream media. And when I talk to you about the advocacy efforts, you'll see how the different elements of the community have come together and is possible because of the strong infrastructure of Asian American community-based organizations and community network in which Danny grew up. On October 3rd, Danny was found dead in Afghanistan as a result of non-combat related injuries. We went to the funeral, and when we were at the funeral in Manhattan Chinatown, we were told that there were marks on Danny's back. That following Monday, the community demanded a thorough and transparent investigation. City Councilwoman Margaret Chin, U.S. Representative Nidia Velazquez, and community-based organizations stood together demanding a thorough and transparent investigation. We put together a video, our first video, featured many people from the community demanding a thorough and transparent investigation that included Asian American veterans, high school, grammar school principals, classmates of Danny's, and the community demanding a thorough and transparent investigation. That video, over 40,000 people have seen that video, and it was put together by Man C. Kong, who is in the back of the room, who documented that video for us. And from there, we had an online petition demanding a thorough and transparent investigation. That online petition generated over 5,000 signatures, and one of the main collectors of those petitions was Head Start. Danny had gone to Head Start before attending grammar school and high school, and the Head Start director remembered Danny and his family and, you know, collected many, many of those petitions, as well as other members of the community. Then we had a historic march from the Army Recruitment Center to Chinatown, and that march brought out over 500 people, sponsored by 35 different organizations, and the range of those organizations, from Chinatown Youth Initiatives to Family Associations to APA labor organizations to college APA ethnic studies programs, etc. And then on the heels of that, we were able to have an historic meeting with members of the Pentagon as a result of the advocacy efforts. In the week following the momentum from the petitions, the marches, et cetera, the Army announced that eight superiors were charged in connection with the death of Danny Chen. And those charges ranged from dereliction of duty to involuntary manslaughter. In January, we were finally told what happened to Danny based on the Army's investigation. And we learned that for nearly a period of 6 weeks, he was subjected to unrelenting abuse, excessive exercises, excessive work details, racial taunting, racial humiliation, and you know, things from being dragged on his back over 50 meters of gravel to being forced to crawl over 100 meters of gravel while other soldiers threw rocks at him, being made to do push-ups and sit-ups with mouthfuls of water that he couldn't spit out or swallow. And he was found dead in the towers of the unit, with a gunshot wound to his head. Now, after that, the community advocated for these trials to be held in the United States. And I'd like to show you a video that we did called Bring It Home. And people who are featured on this video include people from the community, but also people from all over the country who showed support for this case, and we wanted to include them in there as well. And you'll also see Danny's cousins, et cetera, also on this video. Okay.
May 26, 1992. Danny Chen was born in New York City, Chinatown.
June 2010. Danny Chen graduates from Pace High School.
January 2011, Danny Chen enlists in the United States Army.
August 13th, 2011, Private Danny Chen is deployed to Kandahar Province, Afghanistan.
October 3rd, 2011, Private Danny Chen was found dead in a guard tower in Afghanistan. He was 19 years old.
Danny was assaulted, rocks were thrown at him, he was subjected to racial slurs, gook, dragon lady, chink, excessive work details, and guard duty. He was ordered to give directions to other soldiers in Chinese. There were no other soldiers in that unit who could speak Chinese.
The court martials need to take place in the U.S.
We want to see justice being served.
The family has been through absolute hell to give them some measure of closure. They must have the right to be able to face those who are found guilty, to ask them, why did they do this to their son? So I ask the public to join with us in demanding that these trials be held in the United States.
We are Private Danny Chen.
We are Private Danny Chen.
We are Danny Chen. Bring it home.
Bring it home.
Bring it home.
We are Danny Chen.
Bring it home.
We are Danny Chen.
Bring it home.
Bring it home.
We are Danny. Bring it home.
And as a result of this video and a second online petition demanding that these trials be held in the United States, the Army announced a week and a half ago that if these charges are referred to court-martial, they will be held in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. So now we are mobilizing for these trials to take place in North Carolina, expected to begin as early as May, and could potentially go on for the next 8 months. And in order to keep Danny's case alive in the public, and so that the Army knows that we're closely monitoring this case, we have two ongoing campaigns right now. One is a birthday card campaign. Danny would have turned 20 on May 26, Memorial Day weekend of all weekends, right? And So we are doing a birthday card campaign. Mackenzie Yang, OCA New York intern, has copies of birthday cards that you can fill out. You're also welcome to create your own card. Our goal is to collect 10,000 birthday cards. And we are going to deliver them, hand deliver them. We're taking a road trip to Washington, D.C., and we're going to deliver them to the chairs of the Armed Services Committee in the House and Senate. So if you haven't already filled out a card, Mackenzie has extra ones. If you can take extras and get other people to fill them out, that would be great, and then send them to us. We'd appreciate that. And if you can go to the Tumblr website, you'll see, all ages, all occupations, all ethnicities who have filled out birthday cards for Danny. The second event that we're having is on May 24th. We're having a birthday salute to Danny. Artists, many of whom are Asian American artists from all over the country, are coming to perform. Tayo Na, many people may know. Corky Lee, our photographer laureate, will be showing slides of advocacy of Danny's case, and violinist Jason Cao Huang will accompany those photos. We have spoken word artists. We have rap artist Jason Chu performing. And even Danny's cousins will also be performing. This event, which is going to take place on May 24th at Pace High School, where Danny went to school, is again being co-sponsored by a plethora of organizations that shows why New York City is not the time, place to do this incredible mobilization. Asian American Research Institute is also one of the co-sponsors of that event, which is coming up. So we'd be glad to take questions later, but it's I think one thing that this case has taught us is not that our advocacy has gotten more than what Danny or others deserve, but our advocacy has forced the Army to do what they should do in every single case like this, demanding a thorough and transparent investigation and the fullest prosecution under the law.
Thank you so much. That was awesome, and I just want to thank you so much for all the work that you're doing with OCA New York. And this is very raw and very emotional for me too, as someone who suffered from bullying as well, growing up LGBT and Asian. And I know this is really raw for the audience as well. So before we make the shift to Occupy CUNY, I wanted to see if anybody had any immediate questions for Elizabeth about the case.
Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's an excellent question. I just came back from a meeting in Washington, D.C. On April 23rd. We are now in a position to broaden even further the coalition. Locally, Veterans for Peace, Military Families Speak Out, are organizations that have been supporting us in our efforts. Yesterday, Mackenzie and I and representatives from OCA Long Island met with representatives of the Anti-Defamation League here in New York. And on Monday, an impressive array of national APA groups and non-APA groups convened in Washington, D.C. They included Service Legal Defense Network, who were instrumental in repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the military. Representatives who have helped us from Servicewoman Action Network, who have been dealing with military sexual harassment, and ADL National Office was there, American Jewish Community, several groups, who are involved in the anti-bullying campaign, et cetera. So there is an effort to deal connecting slowly with groups involved in anti-bullying, in racial profiling, et cetera, to make those linkages.
Thank you so much. And I'm really glad to hear about the coalition work. We're actually going to move to our next panelist, but please save your questions until the end when we're able to open it up to the audience. All right? Thanks.
The giant is awakening. They kept calling you the giant, right? Right? Get you busy. Pay for that debt. Get in college. Study, study, study. Don't be involved in anything else. Don't waste any time, right? Because they know the power of us students. They do not want us to be educated anymore. They don't need you to be educated. As a matter of fact, they don't want you at all to be educated. The dumber you are, the better. But don't turn off the TV and start doing what you're doing now, which is touching base with those that were in the trenches. How is it done? It's about who has the power and who just is not going to give it up no matter how many times you meet. Revolution has never been simple. Public Enemy said, but it ain't something we ain't did before.
This is Luis Reyes Rivera from the 1969 Takeover.
In 1961, CUNY was established as a university system under the Board of Higher Education. That's what they called it back then. But in the 1960s, barely 5% of the students were, quote unquote, of color. They projected that by 1975, there'd be more colored people in New York City than whites. Therefore, that the city university system would have to change. In other words, some form of admitting people of color into the structure.
If you look at any of your classrooms,
if you look at any of your classrooms,
the lack of diversity is overwhelming.
The lack of diversity is overwhelming.
I feel like the black kid from Recess.
I feel like the black kid from Recess.
There's something you got to understand about the nature of our struggle. We have never been measured from the point of view of difference in class. We have always been measured from the point of view of caste. You're either on the white side of the question or you're on the black side of the question. The Asians, the Native Americans, the so-called Latinos are not included in the discussion. We're not intellectual enough for them. All right? So they have to create programs in order to phase us in so we could hang out with them. Because we never once consider how to evaluate our own intelligentsia and know our history well enough to be able to argue about our own intelligentsia.
I'm a doctoral student.
I'm a doctoral student.
I have worked without a contract. Since I got here in 2005. I stand here today. Humanity.
Individuals, two Puerto Ricans and three African Americans from the United States, decided that they needed to lay some kind of foundation. They did two things that inspired them. One, they spoke to Stokely Carmichael and they sought his advice. And two, they saw this movie called The Battle of Algiers.
Yes.
All right? Now, they selected 10 people who they knew very well and pull them in. And each of the 10, right, recruited another 10. So what 33 people did is they got up to the college, they broke the locks on the gates, changed the locks, right, and asked the guards to leave the campus that they were taking over. By 11 o'clock that morning, more than 400 students were behind that gate. We stayed there for 2 weeks. But when we argue for free tuition, we're not arguing enough. Watch this. We wanted first an institute for third world studies in which we could teach our own about ourselves. We wanted open admissions. I knew a whole lot of smart people who never made it to college because their teachers would deliberately undergrade them. Because those who teach you perceive you as being other than them. Right? Please, when you look at me immediately, what do you see? No. I'm saying whatever that is, that's your initial perception. And when you allow your initial perception to guide you consistently, then there's a wall between us that you insist on maintaining. Wanted the Sikh students to have their own government. We wanted freshman orientation. Why? Well, if I can grab you while you're investigating and I can pull your coat to what you need to know, then when you go and select your major, you can bring the information I gave you with you and help change the educational curricula in that department. Now we're talking about human education. Like it lay, not Western European, right, supremacist orientation that makes us measure ourselves according to them instead of measuring ourselves according to what we bring to the table and what we brought to the table. The other piece was an education requirement, the fifth demand. Because the City University was responsible for producing the majority of people who went into education as a major or as a minor, then they had to have Spanish as a second language as a definitive requirement, and they had to have African American history as a definitive requirement in order to meet their degree requirements. Otherwise, they would know nothing about who they're going to teach. You with me?
Yes. Okay.
The most difficult piece that this culture does not allow is acceptance of difference. Right? You must conform completely to everything I say. And the moment we have difference, we have a war between one another. And that is a weakness of the left. Once you accept the fact of difference, then you can make adjustments as long as we're not violating the principle that's guiding us.
So thank you, Martina and Eva, for sharing that video with us. I know many of you know that Occupy CUNY has wide implications for Asian American students, which are, you know, they number in the tens of thousands in the CUNY system right now. So I wanted to ask, you know, what was your thought process behind creating this video? And do you see elements of what Luis Reyes Rivera, what he's talking about? Do you see it in the Occupy CUNY movement today? And lastly, if you see Asian Americans that are involved in the Occupy CUNY movement, can you talk a little bit about their positionality within that movement?
Okay, so first of all, I want to thank you for inviting us. We're very honored to be here. And I also want to emphasize that we are very happy to participate in this conference in this particular location at the CUNY Grad Center, because this is where we last saw Luis Reyes Rivera in the fall of 2011, and then he passed away in March this year. So it's a very important coincidence for us. We have been covering Occupy Wall Street since the very beginning. from the early days, and then our first two films went viral within a very short amount of time. And soon Liberty Square was covered by other media makers, and we decided that it would be more important for us to amplify the voices of the students within Occupy CUNY. And so we made two films about Occupy CUNY. Do you want to add something? Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Let's see. I just want to kind of refer back to your question, but can you repeat what?
Sure. That was a lot of questions. So my first question was about, you know, like everything that Luis Reyes Rivera was one of the key players in the 1969 occupation of CUNY, which opened up the institution to thousands of communities of color, Black and Puerto Rican students. And so I was very curious about whether or not Occupy CUNY right now has that racial justice lens. Mm-hmm. Because in hearing Luis Rivera talk about the 1969 movement, it shows that it was a movement geared towards racial equity. Mm-hmm. And student and access for students of color. So I wanted to ask if you see that today with the Occupy CUNY movement.
I'll start first with the Occupy movement in general. I think when we first got there, it wasn't so racially diverse, and this was one of the issues that was kind of voiced by that community. In our first film, we tried to kind of suggest that it was racially diverse. And I think that's what brought some people down, because they felt included. Even one of our professors, who is Japanese, was attracted to the film because of thinking that it was racially diverse, but when she got there, she really realized that it wasn't. Mm-hmm. But as the movement grew, she herself realized that, okay, it's not diverse, but that's why I'm here, and that's why I could actually make the difference. And I think as it kind of expanded, then the racial diversity did too. And within the CUNY movement, I don't know, Martina, what do you have to say about
it? Yeah, I think it's also important to emphasize that the encounter that we saw with Luis Reyes Rivera was organized by Students United for a Free CUNY, which is led by people of color. And the other talk was organized by the Africana Studies Group at the Grad Center, and there's a huge overlap between them and Occupy CUNY. And I think what is interesting, if we try to tie together the case of Danny Chen and Occupy CUNY, is that we deal with the revealing the unofficial history of something, right? So in your case, in the first case, the unofficial history is accusing the government of hypocrisy and racism, whereas Occupy CUNY is revealing the unofficial story of CUNY itself, right? And this is why it's so important to emphasize that the occupation in 1969 was fought and led by students of color. And I think that now, 30 years later, we are in a very similar historic moment with Pathways, which is a program at CUNY that tries to
eliminate
ethnic study programs in foreign languages, right? So everything that is like the most radical at CUNY, they try to get rid of it because they know how dangerous these things can become, right? And how threatening. And I very much agree with the first statement in our film by the woman who's speaking and who says, no more dialogue. So I think this is a very comparable moment, right? Like no more dialogue but occupation, no more dialogue but general strike. And at the same time, there's a huge need for dialogue within the people who occupy.
Great. I love the fact that you talked about government transparency and accountability in this case. And I think you're right in that that's a theme in the Danny Chen case. And this is a question for Elizabeth. There is points of connection between Occupy Wall Street and the case of Danny Chen. And I know that Occupy Wall Street members were at the Danny Chen vigil in December. And I wanted to ask you, you know, like, to talk a little bit about that point of connection, if there were tensions that arise, and what it takes for other communities who want to get involved, who aren't necessarily part of the Asian American Pacific Islander community, what is it that they need to know in order to be involved in and take action in the Danny Chen case?
Okay. First, you know, it can't always be assumed that organizations who may share similar visions of economic, political, cultural justice automatically align. We have to educate each other about each other's movements, each other's outlook, and most importantly, each other's constituency. With respect to the march and vigil from the Army Recruitment Center to Chinatown, this was a community-based effort, largely sponsored by community-based Chinatown organizations. We have representatives from Chinese Progressive Association here, one of the sponsors of the march, and, you know, Occupy Wall Street also joined the march. And when I outside, so-called outside groups, join a ethnic community-based movement, it's really critical that they share and touch base with the ethnic community-based organizers as to things that they would like to do at the march and if it's okay. For instance, Bob Lee, who OCA New York has an excellent relationship with, wears dual hats. He's with the Asian American Arts Center as well as with Occupy Wall Street. And he said, you know, he came to OCA New York and said, you know, we want to put a proposal into Occupy Wall Street to have a big banner that says Occupy Wall Street at your march. Is that okay? And we supported that and said, sure, you know, if you, he wanted, you know, because he's with the Asian American Arts Center, he's, you know, he's with people who are artistic and things like that, they could do a really nice banner. And he wanted to put a proposal in for money to make that banner with Occupy Wall Street. And we said, that's fine. We welcome, you know, any group who shares our demand for justice for Danny Chen. Well, you know, so Occupy Wall Street advertised our march from the recruitment center to Chinatown, and someone from Occupy Wall Street came to the march carrying a big flag, a big, big flag of China. And that's loaded with political messages, right? Loaded. And the family who, you know, left China and not necessarily under mixed terms, mixed feelings, when they saw the sign, they got very upset, you know, visibly upset. And, you know, we had to ask the person who was carrying that flag to leave, you know, and that's something, I'm sure he did not mean to upset the family that way, but that's something that should have been run by the organizers, right? You know what I mean? You know, this was not like a little dinky flag. This was huge. It was a big flag. And, you know, so that's that type of thing, I think would have helped. And the other thing, you know, you can't attribute one person's actions for an entire group, right? You know, just like we talked about racial profiling, you know, one person doesn't resemble a whole race or a whole group of people. But this was, you know, a vigil and a march. And reverence for that vigil and march, the tone, was very important. And so it was important for other groups to respect that tone and things. And so, you know, I think that it's just something to keep in mind that coalitions are extremely important, and there are definitely important linkages. But at the same time, you know, there are cultural and racial nuances and norms and customs that need to be respected. People shouldn't assume that what is okay in a majority march is okay in an ethnic, cultural environment.
Thank you. I'm like, I know, like, this is a classic case of traditional organizing, community organizing that's been happening in people of color communities for a while, interacting with a movement that's largely organic, that's horizontal, and I feel like this is going to be a point of tension that we're going to have to talk about. You know, what is the role of the organizations that we have in teaching movements like Occupy and vice versa? What can we learn from Occupy to inform the movements that are happening in our communities today? So thank you so much for speaking so eloquently on that tension. And so we don't have that much time left, and I know it's really hard to talk about all of these things in 45 minutes, and I encourage you to engage with these speakers after the panel, but I wanted to open it up to see if anybody had any questions about either. Yes?
Okay. Both very good questions. Came to our attention, one of our members saw a news article, a very brief clipping of an Asian American soldier from Chinatown, you know, shot, non-combat related injuries, and it looks suspicious. We tried to meet with the family before the funeral and were not successful, and we were told to come to the funeral, and then we would have a meeting with the family, you know, the week after. But everything changed when we went there and were told that there were marks on his back. And, you know, it was, we just went into high gear at that point. Why the difference between having the court martials in Afghanistan versus the United States? After the 8 soldiers were charged, the superiors, then what happens is very much something like an indictment in the United States. There's a hearing to determine whether or not there's sufficient evidence to go forward to trial. That proceeding is called a 32 hearing. And that 32 hearing against all 8 were held in Afghanistan. We had no access to those hearings. We asked if those hearings could be televised at least to the family so they could see what was going on. They have done that before. The Army said they had no plans to do that. So what happens? After the 32 hearings are done, the Army investigator recommends to drop the top charge of involuntary manslaughter against the 5. Maximum penalty for involuntary manslaughter is 10 years. The next charge, negligent homicide, maximum penalty is 3 years. So how powerless is the community in a situation like that? The only thing we could say when the results of the 32 hearings came out was that we're disappointed. But we couldn't criticize what went on in that 32 hearing because we weren't able to have access to it. We didn't know what evidence was presented. We had no way of evaluating what was going on. So we were simply left with a reduced comment of we were disappointed that the charge of involuntary manslaughter was dropped. We didn't know if it was right, if it was wrong. We didn't have any way of evaluating the evidence. So there was a lot of tension less than a month ago because for the trials, the Army wanted the family to go to Afghanistan. When we met with the Army investigators in January to find out what happened to Danny, they were the ones that told us it would be dangerous to go to Afghanistan, and now they wanted the family to go to Afghanistan. Someone's misfortune is our fortune, right? Like when the soldier went berserk and recently killed all those civilians, and understandably, the Afghanistan people were saying they wanted revenge. They definitely couldn't then insist that the family go to Afghanistan for the trials. And so, a week and a half ago, they announced that the trials will be held in the United States if the charges are referred for court-martial. And why is it important? Because we have talked to so many people who have said that if these trials are held in Afghanistan, majority of these trials that are held abroad, they're given a slap on the hand. You know, so it's important that they be vigorously monitored so that they do the best job possible and that they be held in the U.S. Secondly, the family, they want to see who did this to their son. They want to be able to confront them and ask them why. And so it's very critical that they be able to have access. Third reason is, when you said making those connections, this is a hate crime. Different in the sense that it's held in the military, but nevertheless a hate crime. What happened to Danny could have happened to any of your brothers and sisters, your aunts and uncles, your classmate, your neighbor, because of the shape of their eyes, the color of their skin. And so we as a community have a right to see these proceedings, to know that justice will be served, because if we are going to be recruited and to serve, to represent our country, we need to know that our country is going to protect us when these incidences happen.
Thank you. So unfortunately, that's all the time that we have today, but I look forward to having more conversations with y'all in the future. So thank you so much.